Democrats attain the House, Republicans retain the Senate, and Trump maintains his defiant tone. We'll break down the results from the midterms on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Is President Trump willing to accept the fact that the Democrats have won control of the House?
It's hard not to call this a pretty typical midterm setback for the president, and for him to come out and try to act as though it was some sort of unqualified success is just not going to wash.
There's been speculation that the Democrats might try to impeach Trump, but could such an effort backfire?
It's popular in some camps to talk about it, but I think the American people clearly holding judgment there. They want to be shown that this is more than just a political get back.
And a former Republican House leader argues that it's time for both parties to work across the aisle.
We've got a lot of problems. We've got immigration. We've got infrastructure. We've got drug epidemics. These things have to be addressed. And both parties have to play a role, or else no solutions will come about.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 251 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Losing control of the House of Representatives is never an enjoyable moment for a president of the United States. But at the start of Donald Trump's post-election press conference on Wednesday, which included some of the most jaw-dropping moments of a tenure filled with jaw-dropping moments, he focused on the more favorable news.
It was a big day yesterday, an incredible day. And last night, the Republican Party defied history to expand our Senate majority while significantly beating expectations in the House for the midterm and midterm year. We did this in spite of a very dramatic fundraising disadvantage driven by Democrats' wealthy donors and special interests and very hostile media coverage, to put it mildly. The media coverage set a new record and a new standard.
And he extended his wish to have a good relationship with the presumed next speaker, Nancy Pelosi.
I really think, and I really respected what Nancy said last night about bipartisanship and getting together and uniting. She used the word uniting, and she used the bipartisanship statement, which is so important because that's what we should be doing.
But then it sunk to an all too familiar battle with members of the media. In this case, a regular target, Jim Acosta of CNN.
Do you think that you demonized immigrants in
not
this election
no,
to try
I
to
want
keep
them? I want them to come into the country, but they have to come in legally. You know, they have to come in, Jim, through a process. I want it to be a process. And I want people to come in, and we need the people. You know why we need the people, don't you? Because we have hundreds of companies moving in. We need the people.
Right. But your campaign had an ad showing migrants climbing over walls and
so on.
Well,
that's true.
But they weren't actors. They're not going to be doing
that. They weren't actors. Well, no, it's true. Do you think they were actors? They weren't actors. They didn't come from Hollywood. Right. These were people. This was an actual, you know, it happened a few days ago. And
they're hundreds of miles away, though. They're hundreds and hundreds of miles away. That's not an invasion.
I think you should let me run the country. You run CNN.
All right.
And if you did it well, your ratings would be much better.
If I may ask one other question, Mr. President, are you worried?
That's enough. That's enough.
Mr. President, Mr. President, I had one other question, if I may ask, on the Russia investigation. Are you concerned that you may have
I'm not concerned about anything with the Russian investigation because it's a hoax. That's enough. Put down the mic.
Mr. President, are you worried about indictments coming down in this investigation?
Mr. President.
I'll tell you what, CNN should be ashamed of itself having you working for them. You are a rude, terrible person. You shouldn't be working for CNN. Go ahead.
I think that's unfair.
You're a very rude person. The way you treat Sarah Huckabee is horrible. And the way you treat other people are horrible. You shouldn't treat people that way. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Peter.
In Jim's defense, I've traveled with him and watched him. He's a diligent reporter who busts.
Well, I'm not a big fan of yours either. So
I understand.
To be honest.
So let me ask you a question, if I can. You repeatedly
You are the best,
Mr. President. You repeatedly, over the course.
Okay, just sit down, please. Well, when you report fake news, no. When you report fake news, which CNN does a lot, you are the enemy of the people. Go ahead.
And this exchange with Peter Alexander of NBC.
But the question,
okay,
to be clear, to be clear, though, the question,
thank
sir,
you very much.
Why
sit,
are you...
Sit down, Peter.
But the question, but you didn't answer my question, just very simply. The question is, why are you pitting Americans against one another, sir?
I'm not.
Is that how you view citizens
well,
of this country?
I'll tell you what. We won a lot of elections last night. We did very well last night.
And but in many ways,
I think it's going to have a very positive impact. I watched NBC this morning. They didn't report it exactly correctly, but that's, you know, very, very, that's the fact with NBC. Nothing I can do about that. But I want this country to have protection. We want security in our country. I want security, Peter. I mean, you maybe don't think it's so important. And I think when you don't have it, you are indeed unleashing crime. I feel that.
All in all, it was an unusually contentious press conference coming a day after a midterm election. It was followed, not much later, with one held by Nancy Pelosi, the presumed next Speaker of the House. She credited the Democratic takeover of the House on issues she insisted her party shares with the public.
For the people, lower health care costs, bigger paychecks by building the infrastructure of America, integrity in government by reducing the role of big dark money in the political spectrum. That was our agenda. Our candidates ran with it. But health care, in every household in America is an important issue.
All talk about the election on Wednesday was suddenly overtaken by the news that Attorney General Jeff Sessions, as requested by the president, had submitted his resignation. We'll have more about that later in the show. But it does lead to this week's trivia question. When was the last time a senior member of the cabinet quit or was fired the day after an election? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of our last trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. So, what to make of the midterm elections? It wasn't the blue wave some Democrats were hoping for and some Republicans had feared, but the Dems won the big headline. They got a majority of the House, and Nancy Pelosi, or someone else in her party, will be the new Speaker. In the Senate, on the other hand, Republicans did better than expected. They knocked off three Democratic incumbents in North Dakota, Missouri, and Indiana, and four if the results in Florida hold. That's headed for a recount. Only one Republican incumbent went down to defeat, Dean Heller in Nevada. And in the battles for governor, the Democrats got some of what they wanted in states big and small, knocking off, for example, two of their favorite targets, Scott Walker in Wisconsin and Kris Kobach in Kansas. But the highly publicized races in Georgia and Florida, close, but not close enough. Ron Elving is here with his analysis of Tuesday's midterms. He's the asymmetrical senior editor and correspondent for NPR. And as many listeners may remember, he was the other guy in that great political podcast we did together for 7 years. 7 years. Ron, it's great having you on this post-election wrap-up.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Ken. Hey, did you say that the Republicans had picked up four in the Senate?
I say four they have four and they lost one in Nevada.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. Tester has been called for.
Tester won, right? And the only one we don't know is Arizona, as far
right.
as.
Right. Yeah. And that looks like it's going to be McSally. So it looks like it's going to be a net of three.
Right. Greg, or as Frankie Avalon would say, a net of Funicello. Wait.
Hello, is this on?
Yeah.
I know you're out there.
I can hear you breathing. Okay. So Ron, I mean, so much has happened, so many surprises, so many predicted things. What's the headline?
I think the headline is that President Trump's news conference on Wednesday shows the longer it went on, the more he seemed the wounded bear. I think it shows that he knows this was not the midterm result he wanted, even though some of the marquee races that he had devoted his late days of the campaign to, Florida, both Senate and governorship, Georgia, the governorship, Texas, Ohio, certainly South Dakota and Missouri and Indiana, all of those turned up great for the Republicans. And so he's going to focus on that and feel he was personally vindicated. But it was clear from his attitude in the press conference that he took personally the number of Republicans who ran away from him in the House of Representatives, and he gloated in their defeat.
So on the other hand, you had some that decided to, let's stay away, let's stay away. They did very poorly. I'm not sure that I should be happy or sad, but I feel just fine about it. Carlos Cubella, Mike Kaufman, too bad, Mike. Mia Love. I saw Mia Love. She'd call me all the time to help her with a hostage situation, being held hostage in Venezuela. But Mia Love gave me no love, and she lost. Too bad. Sorry about that, Mia.
So what the president was illustrating was that while he was proclaiming himself to be happy, that he thought it was almost a complete victory and things of that nature, clearly he was suffering from a sense of setback and a sense of defeat, which is not his normal mode. I mean, you remember him after the Iowa caucuses in 2016. He scarcely knew how to deal with the disappointment that he suffered there. And there were a couple of other primaries that didn't go his way, Wisconsin, for example, that he was quite disturbed by. But those were passing. They were transitional moments on his way to the nomination. This is much more serious, and he knows how serious it is, and he was indicating that in that news conference on Wednesday. And then finally, in the governorships, while that's a fairly even story, the Democrats took away seven of the Republicans' governorships, and the Republicans didn't take any away. So it's hard not to call this a pretty typical midterm setback for the president. And for him to come out and try to act as though it was some sort of unqualified success is just not going to wash.
Okay, but let's just say that in fairness to the president, the number of House seats lost to the Democrats in the midterm elections were not too dissimilar, too different than what we often see in a first-term president's midterm losses. Think of Bill Clinton losing 54 Democratic seats in 94 and Barack Obama losing 63 seats in 2010. Now, of course, other presidents didn't suffer nearly as much as those numbers, but it wasn't a completely out of realm of possibility numbers that the Republicans lost in the House.
No, the historical average for a president who's under 50% approval, as Donald Trump surely has been since the beginning of his term, that historical average is in the 30s, in the mid-30s. And it seems at this point highly unlikely that the Democrats will have gained more than 30 or so, maybe 33, 34 at the high end. So they're right on the historical average. You can't call this a historic drubbing by any means. Nonetheless, it does give them control of the House. It gives them control of the House despite the fact we're still operating with the Republican map, which is to say, with the exception of Pennsylvania, where the state Supreme Court made them draw a new map. Other than that, all of these states that were heavily gerrymandered by the Republicans after their big win in 2010, that includes North Carolina, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, many other states where they picked up a lot of seats, all of those maps are still in effect, and that means the Democrats managed to overcome those maps to make these big gains. That right there tells you that the national vote, and although we don't know the final national vote, the one referendum we had on President Trump in all 50 states, in all 435 districts, was the vote for the House of Representatives, and the Democrats won that by the kind of margin that would be associated with a pretty sound presidential victory as well.
And now that the Democrats have taken over the governorships in states like Michigan and Illinois, for example, and now that they've solidified their control of the state government in New York, for example, having won the state Senate, redistricting in 2020 could be more decidedly in favor of Democrats than it has been in quite some time.
That's right. The Democrats also managed to take down the supermajorities Republicans had enjoyed in a number of state legislatures. They didn't flip that many state legislatures, but they did improve their situation substantially. If they can continue with that in 2020, they will be more in the driver's seat for the redistricting for the 2020s, for that decade. It only happens once a decade after the decennial census, and it is enormously powerful in determining what will happen in the state legislatures and in the U.S. House for the entire decade that follows.
While I do not want to go into the specific House races, because there are so many to talk about, but there were some that stand out to me, and I want to just briefly mention them. I thought the fact that the Republicans lost the Mark Sanford seat in South Carolina was a big, big surprise. Sanford was beaten in the Republican primary by a candidate who felt he wasn't pro-Trump enough, and then the Democrats took that seat. We mentioned Mia Love in Utah, Dave Bratt, in that's the old Eric Cantor seat in Virginia, that's gone. Dan Donovan in Staten Island, New York, that's gone. John Culberson of Pete Sessions in Texas. There was a seat in Oklahoma City, right. Democrats, I mean, we still don't have final results yet, but the Democrats might beat Rohrabacher in California and the seat of Daryl Issa. So there are some surprises that even though the Democrats were favored to take the House, and I think you and I both agreed that they were going to take the House, there were some seats that said, oh, my goodness, I didn't see that coming.
That's right. I think we looked at the broad averages and the broad prospects of something from the high teens to the 40s. For seat pickups for the Democrats and decided something like 25, 30, 35 was the highest likelihood. That's just basically picking the target in the middle. And that looks like where we're going to wind up. It's rather on historical averages, but it also shows all those ways in which the Democrats have begun to recover, not only just in the last 2 years with Donald Trump's presidency, but recovering from the huge setbacks of 2010 and 2014, where those midterm seats made the Republicans look like they would have majorities in Congress forever.
We mentioned the Democrats who got ousted in the Senate, Heidi Heitkamp, Claire McCaskill, Joe Donnelly, maybe Bill Nelson of Florida. But one person who was not supposed to win and turned out didn't win, and yet he got so much attention, Beto O'Rourke in Texas. He didn't win. He was not supposed to win. 51-48 is not a terrible number for Democrats in ruby red Texas. What do you make of the Beto O'Rourke phenomenon and how close he came?
Well, first of all, Ted Cruz, who was a superstar when he emerged from Texas 6 years ago, and who was really pretty much the last big rival to Donald Trump in 2016 running for president, a superstar in the Republican Party and certainly somebody who saw himself going to the White House eventually, had a near-death experience. Now, of course, he was outspent because Beto O'Rourke raised absolutely phenomenal amounts of money, $38 million in one quarter. These are numbers you just do not associate with a single state in one quarter. And yet, he still lost. And he still lost because, as you say, Texas is still Texas. But look, every single day, Texas is becoming a little less like the Texas that we think of as Texas. It's getting a little younger. It's getting a little less white. The younger population of Texas is already majority-minority, like it is overall in California. And that trend's going to continue. And while Hispanics do not vote uniformly for Democrats at all, the more that the Republican Party pushes Hispanics away and demonizes immigrants, the more they're going to have to deal with a hostile attitude from that same population as they graduate towards being the plurality in Texas, as they are the plurality in California, and down the road could be in Florida, and certainly a major part of the demographics in Georgia, Illinois, New York, and elsewhere.
It also didn't help that Ted Cruz's father worked with Lee Harvey Oswald. That was a big mistake, I thought.
Yeah, I think it was a big mistake bringing that up, actually.
Yeah, but that's what I meant. I'm sorry, I didn't. Actually, my producer told me to say that. But actually, there was an article I saw. What do you think of this? I don't know if it was in The Atlantic, but basically it was saying that Beto O'Rourke could have won the election had he not taken such far left positions in still a conservative state like Texas.
Well, and the same has been said of the Democrats' gubernatorial candidate in Florida, Andrew Gillum, who was talking about basically single-payer medical care, who was talking about a lot of ideas that got him branded a socialist, and seemed to be embracing more of a Bernie Sanders kind of a platform, really, than a standard or a conventional Democratic platform.
In a purple state.
And Florida certainly has elected people from both parties statewide for a number of years, but it hasn't really settled into a pattern of moving leftward. That is certainly the case. And so in that instance, Donald Trump feels that Ron DeSantis got elected governor of Florida because he embraced Donald Trump. I think you could make the argument that had it not been for DeSantis getting the nomination, Gillum would never have had a lead in the polls and would not have finished this close. This was not the Republican strongest candidate in Florida either. So with just a couple of percentage points different in Florida for Senate and governor, and a couple of percentage points different in Georgia, where we may still have a runoff, and a couple of points difference in Texas, if those three marquee states, those four marquee races, had been just a hair different in each case, this would be viewed right now as a historic wipeout for Republicans and for President Trump in particular, because he had embraced each one of those Republican nominees and made that person's fate his own.
You know, we were talking about how far left the Andrew Gillums and the Beto O'Rourkes ran in their respective states, and yet there was a lot of attention on Phil Bredesen in Tennessee, who did not run to the left, who ran as a centrist, because he is a centrist. He supported the Kavanaugh nomination, and yet he got clobbered by Marsha Blackburn in that open Senate seat in Tennessee. So that's a strategy. Running to the center didn't work for Phil Bredesen. And people said, oh, he's by far the best Democrat who could have run. Well, maybe he is the best Democrat, but he didn't win or come close to it.
Exactly. He probably was the strongest candidate they could have put up. And at least in 2018, it just wasn't there for him at all.
And one of the new rising stars in the Senate for the Republican Party is a guy named Mitt Romney.
Yeah, he seems to have quite a lot on the ball, huh? I mean, he's got a big, handsome family, and he's been in business, and he saved the Olympics. I mean, the guy's been everything but governor of Massachusetts.
Well, but he also lost a dog when he was driving too fast.
You know, that hurt him. There's no question about it. You have to be careful how you treat the pooch.
Listen, I think the only Republican pickup for the governor is, I think, Alaska. The Republicans get Alaska. I think Mike DeWine's win in Ohio was much bigger than anybody expected.
Much.
I think the fact that Scott Walker and Chris Kobach went down to defeat were such joyous results for many, many Democrats. But I want to just end this conversation by asking you your thoughts about the announcement that Jeff Sessions is resigning and what it might mean for the Mueller investigation.
I think it's been telegraphed since summer that the president was going to be rid of Jeff Sessions as soon as possible, and that he thought it was best to leave it until after the midterms. And had he done it a week or so ago, and by the way, this was a totally forced resignation, as Jeff Sessions made quite clear in his own letter at the president's request, I am resigning. Had the president done this a week or two ago, it could have cost him. It could have cost him big time. It could have cost him the momentum of his last 10 days of flying around the country and holding rallies for happy Republicans. It really would have been distracting and a bad idea. So they waited, but they didn't wait long after the votes were counted. They were out there with Mr. Sessions' head on a pike. And this is because the senator who was the first senator to endorse Donald Trump, and for many, many months the only senator willing to endorse Donald Trump, he was supposed to come into the Justice Department, be completely loyal to the president, as he had been throughout the campaign, and shut down basically any kind of investigation that was going on there that was inimical to the White House. And the president made it very clear that he was shocked to find out that Jeff Sessions felt he had to recuse himself under Justice Department rules from any sort of involvement in the investigation of the Russian interference.
I never would have appointed him had I known that.
He's made it very clear. He said it again and again. And he has said in interviews that he did it because, well, first of all, that he had fired Comey because Comey was going after the 2016 Russia business too much, and then that he was unhappy with Sessions because Sessions had not shut down Comey. So the tie here, the various stages of this relationship could not be more obvious. The president was shocked that Sessions' previously perfect loyalty should have this flaw and considered it absolutely a fatal flaw. So I believe that we must all expect that what is going to follow could very well be a series of firings, not unlike the Saturday night massacre of 1973, October 20th, that was the beginning of the end for Richard Nixon. Now, I'm not saying this is going to be anywhere near that consequential, but the comparison is going to be made just because the firing of an attorney general over a special investigator who is getting too close to the Oval Office is just part of our heritage. It's part of what we all remember from the Watergate horrors.
And I'm not saying that the new acting attorney general is Robert Bork, but this guy, Matthew Whitaker, has been known to be a strong critic of Robert Mueller.
And a strong adherent and loyalist to the powers of the presidency.
Ron Elving, the senior editor and correspondent for NPR, and my longtime partner during the It's All Politics podcast.
Ah.
Remember the partner quote?
I love that. Just leave it as it is.
Ron, thanks for being on the show.
Always a pleasure, Ken. Take care.
I want to break free. I want to break free. I want to break free from your lies. You're so self-satisfied. I don't need you. I've got to break free.
The election of a Democratic House alongside a Republican Senate is not new in American politics. Ronald Reagan had that for the first 6 years of his presidency. Other presidents have had a House of one party and a Senate of another. But the Democratic victories in the lower chamber this week effectively ends one-party rule in Washington. We'll see if that hampers President Trump's agenda or gives him an issue to run on in 2020. Bob Livingston is probably better equipped to answer the new political reality than anyone else. A Republican member of Congress for more than two decades, rising to chair the Appropriations Committee, he was an architect of the GOP takeover of the House in 1994, after 2 years of Bill Clinton's presidency. And he witnessed the Republican mistakes during the Clinton impeachment saga that helped topple Newt Gingrich 4 years later. Congressman, it's great having you back on The Political Junkie.
Thank you, Ken. I really appreciate your asking me to be back. It's good to be with you.
Well, I'm thrilled you're here, and thank you so much. And President Trump tweeted on Wednesday that the elections were, quote, a tremendous success for him and the Republican Party. How do you see what happened on Tuesday?
Well, it was a mixed bag, but I think actually he did very, very well. He picked up four seats in the Senate. And most of those, in fact, all of those people that won in the Senate races were due to his incredible campaigning around the country. I think he spent more time and energy than any of his predecessors, Republican or Democrat. So I think he can certainly claim credit for that. We lost control of the House, as is usually the case in the off-year election after a president's been elected. But they were expecting a blue wave. There was no blue wave. This was a pretty normal after-year or two-year election following the presidency. The House lost about 32 Republicans, but the Democrats now have a narrow majority. They've got leadership issues, which are yet to be resolved. And on top of that, we lost six governors. That was unfortunate, but when you consider that we kept Texas, Florida, Georgia, Ohio, and several others, it was not a bad evening.
Yeah, I was going to say that even though, I mean, I think the headline should deservedly be Democrats take control of the House, but the big races everybody was watching was, as you say, Texas and Georgia and Florida, And unless a recount changes any of those all went to the Republican Party.
Yeah, I think those were significant because those are the big states that could well determine reapportionment and the outcome of elections into the next decade because of the realignments. Had they gone against the Republicans, it could have been devastating, and I think then it would definitely have been a blue wave, but it didn't turn out that way.
Is there a race or two that especially stand out for you that you're especially pleased about or disheartened by?
Well, I was surprised about Florida because I think in the later hours, people were pretty well counting on Florida going Democrat. So I was heartened by that. The big race, of course, was Cruz versus that guy Beto O'Rourke. Incredible amounts of money were spent. I think the Democrats spent over $70 million on that guy, and yet he still lost. So the fact that Cruz held on in that onslaught was significant. And then my friend Mike DeWine, who's held every imaginable post in Ohio, won the governor's race there. So that was significant. I have to say that on the losses of the Republicans in the House, there were a lot of guys that I really hate to see who lost. There were good, solid congresspeople, but they were in districts that were marginal and were always going to have a fight. Now they've been replaced. And what have they been replaced with? They haven't been replaced by the wacko resistance, hard left Democrats. They've been replaced by solid citizens, people who've served in the armed forces, people who have had significant careers in their own right. Frankly, I think the Democrats' biggest advantage was to put up good candidates, notwithstanding the fact that their party has gone so far crackpot left.
Well, you know something, talk about surprises or maybe things that sounded disheartening. Let me add something else. During his Wednesday post-election news conference, President Trump listed a bunch of Republicans who refused to embrace him and lost. He mentioned Mia Love, Mike Kaufman, Barbara Comstock, Peter Roskam, some others. But he almost sounded gleeful about it, like, too bad, Mike, or Mia didn't show me love. I can't recall a president of any party doing that, singling out his own party's defeated incumbents with ridicule.
Well, President Trump is his own unique character, and I don't think anybody can explain or defend or wants to. I think the country at large looks at his results, and the fact is he's cut taxes, he's replaced judges with strong, principled conservatives. He's tried to fix the health care thing in the aftermath of the Obamacare disaster. And he's stood up to immigration, although the Democrats haven't worked with him yet. I hope that that changes. I look at President Trump's results. I consider most of what he says and most of what the press says about him to be noise, and I try to tune that out. I'm hopeful that the Democrats are going to get off of this resistance kick because that hasn't done them or the country any good. I'm hopeful that regardless of who their leaders are, that this new crop of young people coming in that are all pretty very impressive will moderate the positions of the Democrat Party. And in fact, many of them could end up working with Republicans and advance the agenda of the country despite the inclinations of the most radical Democrats.
Earlier you mentioned about how the Democrats have become the party of resistance in the Trump administration. Could you make the same argument that Republicans were the party of resistance during the Obama years?
To varying degrees. I mean, first of all, there weren't constant investigations, but certainly the opposition was based on policy differences. I mean, they didn't like Obamacare. There wasn't any doubt about it. They didn't think that was in the best interest of the country. He raised taxes. He raised regulations. And they did push back on that. But they didn't push back in a personal sense. And I think that the resistance of the Democrat Party has not only been the pushback against Trump, but to all Republicans who supported him. I mean, witness Maxine Waters saying, face them in the shopping centers and the gas stations and so forth and get in their face and get rid of them. Or the former attorney general who said, when they're down, we kick them. I mean, that stuff's just not helpful. And we didn't do that. I'm out. I've been out for 20 years. Republicans didn't do that. And I think that it was sad commentary on American politics that I hope has reached its peak and will ebb from now on.
You were in Congress in 1980 when Ronald Reagan swept in several dozen new Republicans to the House. And again in 1982 when the GOP lost like 26 seats or something like that. And then, of course, in 1994, you were there when the number of seats won by the Republican Party in the first 2 years of Bill Clinton's presidency reached 54. So you know the ups and downs of election results. I guess what I'm asking is, what do you think the mood in the GOP is now, especially in the House?
Well, I guess it depends on who you talk to. But I think the more rational members would say, you know, we took our shot. This is historically something that can happen, and unfortunately it did happen for their sakes. But they can't get too upset about it. They've got to figure out ways on how they can be productive, and I think if they reach out and try to get stuff done. The people that, frankly, I reject are the hard right and the hard left who say, no, my way or the highway, I'm not going to have a compromise. I'm not going to engage in responsible conduct. I'm just going to oppose. And those kinds of people, whether Republican or Democrat, don't do Congress any justice. They don't do justice to the Constitution, and they certainly don't serve the country well. I'm hoping that that attitude, right or left, is diminished.
Well, there's been a lot of talk about what Trump's approach is going to be with the next Congress, either trying to work out deals with Nancy Pelosi or whomever the speaker is, or use the House as a target, sort of like how Clinton did in advance of his 96 reelection. You know, he ran against Congress, ran against Newt Gingrich. What would be your advice to the president, and what do you think will happen?
He's a deal maker, and he's got to prove that he can make a deal. The framework of the Congress now is shifted. He doesn't have all Republicans in control. And it's time to lower the temperature a little bit if he can. He's kind of at a war with the press, and the mainstream media is at a war with him. I don't know how you reduce that if Jim Acosta's of CNN and those types of people continue to pick at him. But he's a counterpuncher. He's a guy who fights back when he's attacked. If the Democrats want to get along and get stuff done for the country and show that they can be productive, I think he'll receive them and work with them. You know, everybody says he's not an ideologue. He's not a guy that is a strong conservative. He just happens to think that that's in the best interest of the country. But if the Democrats come up with solutions that will work for the country, I think he'll work with them.
You were talking about some of the more radical, you know, members of the Democratic Party. There are moderates as well. You know, some ran as pro-life, pro-gun conservatives as well. But there was, you know, there was a lot of talk about how the GOP Congress and Gingrich overreached after their 1994 takeover. One, do you agree with that assessment? And two, could you see the Democrats making the same mistake?
Yes and yes. We did overreach back then. Right after we took over, we cut the budget substantially, and that worked. And what our efforts ultimately led to balancing the budget for the last time in the last 20 years. But that said, when we tried to force our economic program on the president around Christmas of 1995, we overrode it. We thought we'd get away with anything we wanted. And the president just said, well, okay, then we'll close the parks and we'll close the museums and we'll close the whatever other access facilities that people like to do about Christmas time. And Republicans capitulated because we got beat. The closings didn't work in our favor. And we did overstep ourselves. In this instance, just a year or two ago, the Democrats overstepped themselves and tried to close the government to force some of their programs on President Trump. That didn't work either. This Constitution calls for people to come together. When they do come together, stuff gets done. We've got a lot of problems. We've got immigration. We've got infrastructure. We've got drug epidemics. These things have to be addressed, and both parties have to play a role, or else no solutions will come about. And I'm kind of heartened by some of the people that have been elected on the Democrat side just in this new crop.
Before we go, you're the author of a new book, The Windmill Chaser, Triumphs and Less in American Politics. What's that about?
Well, it's basically about my favorite subject, Ken. It's about me. But it's just a compendium of funny stories and a lot of history about a guy who is just a normal fella raised in the 50s and 60s who grew up in America with no particular political background and certainly no money, but who rose to the very top of the congressional leadership. And the trip on the way through as a lawyer, as a prosecutor, as a 22-year congressman, and now in the afterlife as a lobbyist. And my observations as we went along, I talk about my mistakes and Republican mistakes and Democrat mistakes, but most importantly, I talk about how when things worked and when we got along, I was happy as a clam. And I just enjoyed the whole run, and I thought that I had a story to tell, and so I wrote it down, was encouraged to put it in the book, and that's what I've done.
Shouldn't the title have been Bob Livingston, I presume?
Oh, it could be Dr. Livingston, I presume. Actually, I was known as Doctor in high school because of that old adage when Stanley found Livingston in Africa. But no, I thought my title represented my wins and losses in American politics. I had both. I had a lot of successes. I had a few failures. But I met a lot of wonderful people along the way and didn't do it by myself. Had tremendous support.
If memory serves, there really wasn't much of a Republican Party in Louisiana when you were first elected, right?
No, we built the Republican Party from scratch. My mentor in politics was Dave Treene, who became the first Republican congressman and the first Republican governor since Reconstruction in Louisiana. And then Henson Moore was the second Republican congressman, and I was the third. So there was no Republican Party when I was growing up. And now, in Louisiana, unless you're in the city of New Orleans, the fact is you can't get elected unless you're a Republican.
Bob Livingston served in the House for more than 20 years. He won a special election in 1977 and served until 1999, rising to become the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. He heads up the Livingston Group, a lobbying firm in Washington. Bob, it was great having you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me again. It's great to talk to you.
Dr. Livingston, I presume, stepping out of the jungle gloom into the midday sun. What did you find there? Did you stand a while and stare? Did you meet anyone? I've seen butterflies galore. I've seen people big and small. I've still not found what I'm looking for.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of our last trivia question, which was, what state has gone the longest since last electing a Democrat as governor? The answer, South Dakota. In 1974, the voters reelected Richard Kneipp to the governorship. That was the last time. And the Mount Rushmore state continued the Republican winning streak this week, electing Kristi Noem, who became the state's first female governor. And the randomly selected winner is Matt Foraker of Washington, D.C. Matt wins the coveted political junkie button. And we have a scuttlebutt winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. Our last contest led off with a button that said, Be Democratic, beat that tax, with B in quotes, obviously for line B on the ballot. Then one that said, You know I'm for you doll. An I Love Mr. T button from the TV show. A United Citizens for Nixon button with a big N in the middle. the omnipresent D. Huddleston for Senator button from Kentucky, and finally a button of King Kong climbing up the World Trade Center in New York. So when you combine B and U and T and N and D and this large gorilla climbing up a building, you kind of get B-U-T-N-D Beast. And the winner is Jane Grabenstein of Monroeville, Pennsylvania. We'll have a new Scuttlebutt puzzle up on our website this weekend. You can find that as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Certain as the sun, rising in the east, tale as old as time, song as old as rhyme, Beauty and the Beast. Shh. Tale as old as time, song as old as rhyme, Beauty and the Beast.
Come January, it'll be a new day in Washington, at least in the House of Representatives. The Democrats have won enough seats in this week's midterms to give them a majority that they last held in 2010. For a party that has been thwarted in its bid to investigate President Trump or to have some oversight, it's their first chance to exercise some power. Vic Fazio may have some advice for them. He served in Congress as a Democrat from California for 2 decades, first elected in 1978 and serving until 1998 when he retired. He served as chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. He's seen good days and bad days. And he's a guest this week on The Political Junkie, which I hope is part of the good days. Congressman, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Well, you know, I used to cover you back in the late 80s and early 90s when it seemed like the Democratic control of the Congress or of the House would last forever. And I think for some Republicans, it felt like forever. But that was a long time ago.
Well, you know, who changed that? I have to give credit to him. I'm not a big fan. Newt Gingrich, who remains a political guru for Donald Trump today. But Newt organized the forces of the right and won a major victory in 1994, only to be shown the door by his own troops 4 years later. But he did bring back an era of Republican dominance, which Nancy Pelosi was able to bring it into the next decade.
What do you think accounts for the Democratic comeback in the House this year? Is it solely about Donald Trump, or is it more than just that?
I think it's more than just that. Just as the, in 94, Newt gave Republicans hope within his party conference. You know, I think Democrats under Pelosi's leadership, taking advantage of the times, you know, the president's unpopularity, the economics of the moment, all of that plays into the hands of a strong legislative leader who instills hope and can help raise money and recruit candidates. So, you know, I think what really happened in the 90s was the Southern Democrats went away. Lots of vacant seats, which Republicans were able to win. And in this instance, this time, a lot of Republican retirements. And so Democrats had opportunities to win open seats that they, you know, largely took advantage of. But, you know, both of those eras reflected a party tired, people really wanting to go, people not expecting to get reelected. And so a little bit of that becomes more than just a prophecy. It becomes reality.
Well, now that the Democrats have regained the majority after 8 years, what do you think their priority should be in the House?
Well, obviously, oversight has been sadly lacking in the last couple of years. You know, when Republicans wanted to pin down Hillary Clinton and reduce her popularity around the Benghazi effort, they had endless oversight hearings on Benghazi. I don't want Democrats to go down that route. I think there are plenty of legitimate issues that have popped up in the first 2 years of the administration that deserve to be looked at by the Congress. It's their responsibility and duty to do it. I don't want it to become just a feasting, though, a gotcha every week in every committee. I think it has to be focused as much as possible on substance. For example, how we get out of the health care quandary we're in. A lot of work could be done that, at least in the early going, would give President Trump the opportunity to reach out if he's so inclined. I doubt that he will be, but I still think if there's room for accomplishment in the first year, particularly before he is campaigning for re-election, although frankly, he's always campaigning for re-election. You know, this has to be the opportunity, maybe an infrastructure package, maybe a making of the last tax cut a little bit more focused on the middle class, maybe some efforts, as I said, to remedy or fix the Affordable Care Act. I mean, these are things that really need to be done. And frankly, if they would put a immigration reform bill out on the floor the way it passed the Senate by a 2-to-1 margin a couple of years ago, we could do that too and deal with the DACA issue and do what we can to increase border security. So there's a lot that could be done. I'm afraid I'm a bit skeptical about the president's openness to doing that. He's so reflexive. And when he's criticized and from his perspective attacked, usually fights back and all the good intentions go out the window.
And I was going to say, even putting aside President Trump, much of what the House could propose and pass could very well die in the Republican Senate.
That's true. And I think it would be interesting to see, you know, just what Mitch McConnell wants to do, because he's got a lot of his members up for re-election on the Republican side in 2 years as well. They're on the ticket with Donald Trump, and we haven't really figured out just the full implications of that yet. But secondly, just as the Senate map was heavily focused on Democratic seats this time, it'll be heavily Republican next time. So he may, more than the president even, want to have some legislative accomplishments that he can allow his members to campaign on.
Are there some new Democratic faces we should be paying attention to in the next Congress?
Well, you know, there are an awful lot of very strong women who ran this time and won races in places that had heretofore not always supported Democrats. Mikey Sherrill, who won in northern New Jersey, Navy copter pilot, very impressive campaign, causing the incumbent to retire and then building a campaign that defeated the state legislator who tried to succeed him. We have candidates in Virginia that have won, three women elected, two of them with strong national security backgrounds. I think you're going to see not only more diversity, but you're also going to see more varied backgrounds getting out of kind of the stereotypes that you might have assumed. And I think that will make a number of people notice fairly quickly during their new time in the House of Representatives.
We were talking earlier about the midterms of 2006. And I remember back then when the Democrats were on the cusp of taking back the House and making Nancy Pelosi Speaker, there were quite a few in your party who were calling for the impeachment of President Bush and Vice President Cheney. And I remember Pelosi back then insisting that impeachment wasn't in the cards. There is no shortage of calls now for the impeachment of President Trump. And once again, Nancy Pelosi is putting them off. Is she right?
I think so. You know, first of all, impeachment isn't about removing people from office that you don't agree with, or in this case, even find distasteful. The real question is, have there been any high crimes and misdemeanors? And, you know, really, if there have been, it's within the purview of Mr. Mueller in his special counsel role. As long as his report is completed and all of the work that he wanted to do is behind him, then I think we'll have a better sense of whether there are any impeachable offenses. Up until that time, it's a distraction. It's popular in some camps to talk about it, but I think the American people clearly are holding judgment there. They want to be shown that this is more than just a political get back. And I happen to think that the leadership on the Democratic side sees that. It's easy to loathe a man you find, everything that you dislike in politics. But, you know, the voters put him there, and the voters will have to deal with him going forward. Unless, in fact, there are things that we don't yet know that will be brought out regarding Russian involvement, for example, with WikiLeaks, et cetera, it's much too early to make any kind of charge that I think would stand up not only in Congress, not in the House, but with the American people. And most of all, as long as the president's popularity with Republicans is as strong as it is currently, very hard to see the Senate convicting, as they refused to do when Bill Clinton was impeached.
What's your relationship with Pelosi? I know the two of you served together in the House for, I think, about 10 years.
Yeah, we served on appropriations together. We're still good friends, as I am with other members of the Democratic leadership who've been there a while. They're my peers in many ways. And I have high regard for what they've been able to accomplish, not only in the period when they were in power, but in reclaiming the majority. But there's clearly a lot of restiveness among the younger members, and there's going to have to be some accommodations, I think, going forward in order to find Democrats unified and working together.
Well, expanding on that, I mean, there are quite a few that who ran on the promise not to support her for another term as Speaker. And, you know, as you know, she's 78 years old, and many have called for new leadership. How do you respond to that, considering the fact that it seems like she wants another term as Speaker?
Well, I don't think there's any question. She wants to not only be the first woman elected Speaker, she wants to be one of the few ever to return to the Speaker's chair, Sam Rayburn of Texas being the last one. But I don't know that the younger members are necessarily ready to reject her leadership. I think there are some who will find it impossible to vote for, given that they've made a solemn promise in a recent election. And so how she handles herself in dealing with her caucus over the next month or so will be, I think, determinative as to whether she has the votes on the House floor to be elected Speaker. I don't think there's any question she would have the votes in the Democratic caucus, but do they rise to the level that would allow her to win on the House floor when you need a majority of those present and voting?
Vic Fazio served 20 years on the House as a Democrat from California from 1979 through 1998. He's a senior advisor in the law firm of Akin Gump in Washington. Vic, it was great having you on the program.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Going backwards, once in a while.